This is December 30th, 2007, last Sunday of the year. And for Taisho today, I'm going to read from and comment on a book called Mindless Eating. You know, this is the time when I think many of us, it's one of the times when we stand our best chance of changing our habits and bringing new discipline to our lives at the beginning of a new year. It's widely known that health, fitness clubs and yoga places and all have a big uptick in January, where people are just sick of indulging, overindulging in food and maybe socializing, and we're ready to get back to basics and buckle down and get some discipline back into our lives. And I read this book a couple months ago, and I thought I'd save it for this propitious time. The title is what caused me to buy it. I've never bought a book on eating before. After buying it, like most of the books I get, it just sat for a while, months, I think, and then I heard from a Sangha member, heard it recommended highly by a Sangha member who had lost something like 60 pounds after being inspired by this book. And since it seemed to me that probably not many of us can claim to have completely mastered the whole eating thing, in terms of either quality or quantity, it might be worth getting into this, because it is I think it's unique. It seems to be. I don't know. I haven't read any other diet books, but it's has a whole different approach to it, and it's one that's not based on eating this or that, any particular kind of food, but just our relation. Well, I'll read the subtitle: Why We Eat More Than We Think, and it's by Brian Wansink, PhD. He got his doctorate at Stanford and is director of the Cornell University Food and Brand Lab. He's from Iowa. He is the John S. Dyson Professor of Marketing and Nutritional Science at Cornell University, where he's director of the Cornell Food and Brand Lab. There are ways in which his findings, the findings of his research, his food lab's research, are kind of an analog for practice, for zazen, Zen practice. So I'll be sprinkling those observations in too as we go along. He starts off by saying that that his lab's research has shown that the average person makes well over 200 decisions about food every day, 90% of which we aren't even aware of. He says this book is not about dietary extremism, just the opposite. It's about re-engineering your environment so that you can eat what you want without guilt and without gaining weight. It's about re-engineering your food life so that it is enjoyable and mindful. Food is a great pleasure in our life, not something we should compromise. We simply need to shift our surroundings to work with our lifestyle instead of against it. This book uncovers the hidden persuaders that lead us to overeat and shows how to eliminate them. He asks, is this a diet book? He says, to those of us who love food, a diet is pretty much die with a T on the end. In fact, diet comes from a Latin word which means a way of life. And then there's on the frontispiece of the book, there's this statement I think that really captures the real essence of this book. It says, the best diet is the one you don't know you're on. And the first chapter is called The Mindless Margin. He says, we overeat because there are signals and cues around us that tell us to eat. It's simply not in our nature to pause after every bite and contemplate whether we're full. As we eat, we unknowingly, that is, mindlessly, look for signals or cues that we've had enough. For instance, if there's nothing remaining on the table, that's a cue that it's time to stop. If everyone else has left the table, turned off the lights, and we're sitting alone in the dark, that's another cue. For many of us, as long as there are still a few milk-soaked Fruit Loops left in the bottom of the cereal bowl, there is still work to be done. You know, I had dinner somewhere here in the United States with someone from another country, and the waiter came and there was, I wasn't finished eating a certain dish, and he said, are you still working on that? And this person from another country said, working on it? It doesn't, he says, it doesn't matter if we're full, and it doesn't matter if we don't even really like Fruit Loops. We eat as if it is our mission to finish them. That's a real challenge for those of us who take wasting food seriously, and especially those of us in that group who were conditioned as children to eat everything on our plates as well, and who were strongly praised for eating a lot. He says also later in the book that that's more of a male thing. It's really an odd thing that as boys we get really strong reinforcement, positive reinforcement for just eating like pigs. It's one of these gender differences that he mentions later. And then just a couple of these intriguing studies that his food labs does. First, the nature of this. Food psychology labs typically study human behavior, and these labs look like mock living rooms, kitchens, or restaurants. Some might be rigged with one-way mirrors, camouflaged cameras, and tables that have hidden scales under the plates. Others might include a row of cramped, 3 feet wide tasting booths where people can taste test different foods without being distracted. Still others might have small, soundproof rooms for in-depth interviews or larger rooms where groups are brought in to answer psychological surveys related to food. So that's the context of the studies that he reports on here. First, the popcorn one. I'm just going to summarize it. It's where people came in and they were told that everyone who bought a came into a movie, and everyone who bought a ticket was given a soft drink and either a medium size bucket of popcorn or a large size, bigger than your head bucket. They were told that the popcorn and soft drinks were free, and that we hoped they would be willing to answer a few questions afterward. But there was one catch. This wasn't fresh popcorn. It was 5 days old. And what they found was that the people ate more if you gave them a bigger container. No other variables. They weighed them. They weighed the amount left when they came out, and they found that the bigger the bag, the more people ate. And he says here, did people eat because they liked the popcorn? No. Did they eat because they were hungry? No. They ate because of all the cues around them. Not only the size of the popcorn bucket, but also other factors I'll discuss later, such as the distracting movie, the sound of people eating popcorn around them, and the eating scripts we take to movie theaters with us. All of these were cues that signaled it was okay to keep on eating and eating. But here's the interesting thing is that when they were asked these questions afterward, they were told some people tonight were given medium-sized buckets of popcorn and others, like yourself, were given these large-sized buckets. We have found that the average person who is given a large-sized container eats more than if they are given a medium-sized container. Do you think you ate more because you had the large size? Most disagree. Many smugly said, that wouldn't happen to me. Or things like that don't trick me. Or I'm pretty good at knowing when I'm full. And this is one of the leitmotifs of the book is the unawareness, how easily we are deceived, how easily we deceive ourselves. I did a similar thing with wine. They invited people in. They set up this studio, this food lab, as a restaurant. They invited people in, and they served this cheap wine called used to be called 2 Buck Chuck or 3 Buck Chuck. Yeah, your teacher knows a few things about this. I get around. All right. But the half of the bottles had an elegant label from a California winery. And then on the other half of the bottles, the label read, a North Dakota winery. So the ones, it was all the same wine, and then they did they interviewed them and everything, and they weighed the amount of food they ate. This isn't just about wine. The ones who had the wine with the North Dakota label rated the wine as tasting bad and their food as less tasty. And they ate less food. The ones with the California wine ate 11% more of their food. And he says, now to a cold-eyed skeptic, there should have been no difference between the two groups. They should have eaten the same amount and enjoyed it the same. They didn't. They mindlessly ate. That is, once they were given a free glass of, quote, California wine, they said to themselves, this is going to be good. Once they concluded it was going to be good, their experience lined up to confirm their expectations. This is one of the dangers. Also, just expectations is one of the biggest obstacles in practice. And it works both ways in Zazen, where if you're going in, let's say, to a sesshin, that's where everything is more intensified, and you expect to have a lot of pain, physical pain, then that sometimes causes you to have more physical pain. It's the thought of it. Or if you go into practice generally with the expectation that you're going to see yourself change overnight or in a few weeks, then that also can derail. Derail some people because expectations always set us up for disappointment. And he says here, in the thousands of debriefings we've done for hundreds of studies, nearly every person who was tricked by the words on a label, the size of a package, the lighting in a room, or the size of a plate, these are all factors that he shows cause us to eat more, said, I wasn't influenced by that. They might acknowledge that others could be fooled, but they don't think they were. This is what gives mindless eating so much power over us. We're not aware it's happening. There's a little thing here about called anchoring. where they give you, you're given a, right, grocery shoppers who saw numerical signs such as limit 12 per person would buy much more than those who saw signs such as no limit per person. And they found that almost any sign with a number promotion leads us to buy 30 to 100% more than we normally would. I'm thinking of signs I've seen in Wegmans in the fruit section called Strive for Five. Are they kidding? And now more about his main point. He said, we've all heard of somebody's cousin's sister who went on a huge diet before her high school reunion, lost tons of weight, kept it off, won the lottery, and lived happily ever after. Yet we also know about 95 times as many people who started a diet and gave up in discouragement, or who started a diet, lost weight, gained more weight, and then gave up in discouragement. After that, they started a different diet and repeated the same depriving, discouraging, demoralizing process. Indeed, it's estimated that over 95% of all people who lose weight on a diet gain it back. And then, and there's a footnote here, the speed at which you gain weight after going off a diet is almost always directly related to the speed you lost the weight to begin with. If you miraculously lose 10 pounds in 2 days with the new celebrity fad diet, capital C, capital F, capital D, you're likely to miraculously gain it back almost as fast. Most diets are deprivation diets, he writes. We deprive ourselves or deny ourselves of something. Carbohydrates, fat, red meat, snacks, pizza, breakfast, chocolate, and so forth. Unfortunately, deprivation diets don't work for 3 reasons. One, our body fights against them. Two, our brain fights against them. And three, our day-to-day environment fights against them. Millions of years of evolution have made our body too smart to fall for our little I'm only eating salad trick. Our body's metabolism is efficient. When it has plenty of food to burn, it turns up the furnace and burns our fat reserves faster. When it has less food to burn, it turns down the furnace and burns it more slowly and efficiently. This efficiency helped our ancestors survive famines and barren winters, but it doesn't help today's deprived dieter. If you eat too little, the body goes into conservation mode and makes it even tougher to burn off the pounds. This type of weight loss is not mindless. It's like pushing a boulder uphill every second of every day. And this is the flip side of his very clever title, Mindless Eating. There, on the one side, it's just the little awareness we have in our eating. But the flip side is that we can also, by re-engineering our environment, we can arrange things so that we can mindlessly lose weight if we're patient enough. That's the key thing. That's what I trust so much about this book, is the strong demand, the strong importance of patience. It takes time. How much weight loss triggers the conservation switch? It seems that we can lose 0.5 pound a week without triggering a metabolism slowdown. And then any diet that is based on denying yourself the foods you really like is going to be really temporary. The foods we don't bite can come back to bite us. Well, here's a little item from News of the Weird of October 2005. A nationally known psychologist and expert on eating disorders was arrested in a West this is too weird in a West Hartford, Connecticut convenience store after, according to police, passing out from inhaling the aerosol from 3 cans of whipped cream. He goes on, we have millions of years of evolution and instinct telling us to eat as often as we can and to eat as much as we can. Our bodies fight against deprivation and our brains fight against deprivation. And then there's much later in the book, he says here, we are hardwired to love the taste of fat, salt, and sugar. Fatty foods gave our ancestors the calorie reserves to weather food shortages. Salt helped them retain water and avoid dehydration. Sugar helped them distinguish sweet edible berries from the sour poisonous ones. Through our taste for fat, salt, and sugar, we learned to prefer the foods that were most likely to keep us alive. I couldn't help but think of the analogy here in sitting, that we seem to be hardwired to grasp at thoughts. You know, I've been asked a million times, why is it so hard to pull free of the thoughts, the trains of thought and fantasies in the mind? It's because somehow there has to be some evolutionary value, some survival value to doing that. So we just do this almost instinctively, chase after thoughts and fantasies. It's like the fat, salt, and sugar, but we don't need to. It's just this huge lag. And then he says, the good news is that the same levers that almost invisibly lead you to slowly gain weight can also be pushed in the other direction to just as invisibly lead you to slowly lose weight, unknowingly. And then he goes on, no one goes to bed skinny and wakes up fat. Most people gain or lose weight so gradually they can't really figure out how it happened. They don't remember changing their eating or exercise patterns. All they remember is once being able to fit into their favorite pants without having to hold their breath and hope they can get the zipper to budge. Sure, there are exceptions if we gorge ourselves at the all-you-can-eat pizza buffet, then clean out the chip bowl at the Super Bowl party, then stop by the Baskin-Robbins drive-thru for a belly-buster sundae on the way home, we realize we've gone too far over the top. But on most days, we have very little idea whether we've eaten 50 calories too much or 50 calories too little. In fact, most of us wouldn't know if we ate 200 or 300 calories more or less than the day before. This is the mindless margin. It's the margin or zone in which we can either slightly overeat or slightly undereat without being aware of it. If we eat way too little, we know it. If we eat way too much, we know it. But there is a calorie range, a mindless margin, where we feel fine and are unaware of small differences. So it's 100 to 200 calories difference. He tells the story of a woman who lost 20 pounds during her first 2 years at a new job. She was asked what she'd done differently. She said nothing. And then they pressed her and said, oh yeah, I switched from coffee to herbal tea. And because I gave up caffeine, I also stopped drinking Coke. She'd been drinking about 6 cans of Coke a week, far from a serious habit. But the 139 calories in each Coke translated into 12 pounds a year. She wasn't even aware of why she'd lost weight. In her mind, all she'd done was cut out caffeine. And then he says, cutting out our favorite foods is a bad idea. Cutting down on how much of them we eat is mindlessly doable. And then he offers, at the end of each chapter, he offers his kind of a summary of the chapter. He calls the re-engineering strategy. So the re-engineering strategy number one is think 20% more or less. Dish out 20% less than you think you might want before you start to eat. For fruits and vegetables, think 20% more. Now, this matter of re-engineering our environment, he gets into a lot more detail as the book goes on. I think this is one of the, just about the only thing we can rely on in a daily sitting, maintaining a daily sitting practice, other than just sheer willpower, is making it easier for us to get to the mat. I outline some suggestions at every workshop. I'll just run through some of them quickly right now. I think the most important thing is to get yourself to the mat first thing in the morning. Get up earlier, even if that means getting to bed later, but sit first of all. I have to be careful here. Not to make an absolute out of this, because some people, I'm a morning person, and there's nothing I'd rather do than sit first thing in the morning. Other people have more difficulty for whatever reasons, but still, something has to be done, and that, I think, is the best. Because if you don't sit first thing in the morning, if you start doing other things, then you're less likely to get to it later. I think I've heard from most people. Or if you for some reason you're one of these people who can't do it first thing in the morning, or just find it too difficult, then do it every night or do it when you get home from work. But I think you stand a better chance of doing it if you have a regular time in the morning or afternoon or evening when you do it. And then another thing, in terms of re-engineering your environment, is to have a place that you always go to, a corner of your room, a zendo if you have a house. Go to this place that's reserved just for sitting, and keep it clean. If it probably might help slightly to have it set up nicely with a mat of some kind, the right cushions, maybe a photograph of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva figure, incense, all these little things, clothes, having the same set of clothes, a robe, if not a robe, then some loose clothing that works for you. In the aggregate, these things all together can make the difference, can be a tipping point where the seductions of other things, of food, breakfast, TV, internet, all these things, you can overcome them, if more likely to, if you can get these things all arranged. Of course, you could say that the most basic re-engineering, the Maha re-engineering, is to join a residential training program, staff or something else like that. The genius of that is that it removes the choice. When you're on staff, you don't have a choice of whether you said, oh, should I sit this morning or not? There are one or two mornings a week when we have that choice, but otherwise, it's morning and night sitting, And that really helps. And because so much of the daily schedule is so highly regulated and structured, this way reduces decisions. Mentioned about the 200, he said they found that the average person makes well over 200 decisions about food every day. Not only do we have a lot fewer food decisions when you're on staff, but you have a lot fewer decisions of all kinds regarding what you do with your schedule. But of course, that's most people will not be able to be in a residential training program. So then you do whatever you can to structure your environment at home. Here's another study he presents. That we believe our eyes, not our stomach, he shows. People don't eat calories, they eat volume. So he presents a case where they invite college students into this food lab that's presented as a restaurant, and they're given all the free buffalo wings they can eat. But they're separated into two groups. In one group, the waitresses come and they clear away the bones of the buffalo wings that are there on the table. In the other group, they leave them there. And as you might expect, the students who didn't have the bones removed ate less because they could see what they'd eaten. Another one is, another study he presents is the bottomless soup bowl, where they invite people in and they serve them soup, and they can eat as much soup as they want. What they don't know is that under the table there's a device where they have a tube running from some huge vat of soup, and then they just let people go at it and eat as much soup as they want. Let's find that one. They had 62 people who showed up for lunch to enjoy the soup, and only two of them figured out what was occurring. One bent down to retrieve a drop napkin and quickly pointed out the Borg-like tubing under the table. They ate a phenomenal amount because they were going by what they saw, that their bowl still had soup in it. Most were still eating when we stopped them, 20 minutes after they began. The typical person ate around 15 ounces, but others ate more than a quart. When one of these people was asked to comment on the soup, his reply was, "It's pretty good, and it's pretty filling." And then he comments, "Sure it is." He had eaten almost three times as much as the guy sitting next to him. They had just one bowl, like rigged up like this, and then the others just were regular bowls, and they ate a lot less. You know, we laugh. But the point he makes over and over through this book is how we deceive ourselves, how we fall for these cues, like the what we see. He He points out that we usually try to eat the same visible amount of food we're used to eating. If a person thinks he ate less than that typical volume, he'll think he's hungry. If he thinks he ate more, he'll think he's full. Volume trumps calories. People don't eat calories, they eat volume. He also talks about signal clothes. Most people don't weigh themselves much. How do they know? They're asked, how do they know when they're gaining weight? And they ask 322 people this, and these are the answers they get. Well, my jeans feel comfortable again. Let's see. The top eight signals people use in to know they've lost weight. When my jeans feel comfortable again, when I have to start wearing a belt, when I suck in my stomach and I can see some definition, when my belt notch moves back to where it used to be, when I don't get tired walking up two flights of stairs to my office, when I can see my cheekbones, when I don't have to inhale to button my pants, when friends or colleagues ask me if I've lost weight. Here's another thing, speed. The faster we wolf down our food, the more we eat. And this is what's interesting. I think many people will know this intuitively. It takes up to 20 minutes for our body and brain to signal satiation so that we realize we are full. So there's this lag. We're eating away, and then we keep eating, and suddenly we discover that we've overeaten. And here's the problem, he says. We Americans start, finish, and clear the table for many of our meals in less than 20 minutes. Our meals are remarkably short. And so his re-engineering strategy number two is see all you eat. See it before you eat it. Put everything you want to eat on a plate before you start eating. And then see it while you eat it. And that refers to the buffalo wings thing. It's easy to forget how much soda you've had if there's nothing to remind you. One way is to count beverage empties. And then is a chapter called Surveying the Tablescape. And they found through the research that we all consume more from big packages, whatever the product. Give people a large bag of dog food, they pour more. Give them a large bottle of liquid plant food, they pour more. Give them a large shampoo bottle or container of laundry detergent, they pour more. And so forth. This is why it's so hard to get a smaller size of things at supermarkets. They just want you, of course, to use more. The only exception to this was liquid bleach, which some people seem to know. He says, their socks and shirts experience a religious conversion. They become holy. And then there's the vertical illusion that tall, narrow glasses, when we drink out of tall, narrow glasses, we'll drink less. The people given a short, wide glass poured an average of 19% more juice or soft drink than those given the tall, thin glass. So, he says, use only tall, skinny glasses. Big serving dishes and big spoons are big trouble. As the size of our dishes increases, so does the amount we scoop onto them. They cause us to serve ourselves more because they make the food look so small. All these things, most of these things, when we hear them, we say, well, of course. But again, it's how easily we are deceived by them because of our lack of awareness. Variety increasing the variety of a food increases how much everyone eats. If you're trying to control your weight, one obvious implication is not to eat every meal at the Kung Pao Gardens 2,000 item buffet. You can also stop thinking that every meal should consist of four or five different foods. So this is another danger with potlucks. He shows over and over that the more variety is offered, the more we eat. So re-engineering strategy number three, be your own tablescaper. Mini-size your boxes and bowls. Become an illusionist. Drop your platter-sized dinner plates off at Goodwill. Pick up a nice set of mid-sized plates that you can be proud of. Beware of the double danger of leftovers. The more side dishes and little bowls of leftovers you bring out of the refrigerator, the more you will eat. Here's another rule they have found. Out of sight, out of mind. In sight, in mind. Simply thinking of food can make you hungry. Another rule, the more hassle it is to eat, the less we eat. Again, common sense. But then he offers all kinds of specific ways of making it a little less convenient to snack, for example. And that sort of goes back to somewhat the kind of strategies one can employ with sitting. I suppose that the biggest temptations, or two of the biggest temptations to take us away from sitting at home is the television and the computer. So to try to work on the discipline to not turn on the computer in the morning until you've done your sitting. Or the TV. Once it's on, I think most people find that it's harder to resist, and then you get swept away into all directions with in those two devices. Chopsticks. They found that because chopsticks slow you down in your eating, you eat less. He reports out of 33 people eating with chopsticks, 26 were normal weight and only 7 were obese. Talks about the curse of the warehouse club when you get these huge quantities of things. And the two ways, one thing is because of the size of the boxes, you use more. And then because it takes so long to go through these huge boxes and bags, you end up throwing out often some of the stuff. So re-engineering strategy number four, make overeating a hassle, not a habit. Leave serving dishes in the kitchen or on a sideboard. Deconvenience tempting foods. Snack only at the table and on a clean plate. And then he talks about mindless eating scripts. When we eat, we often follow eating scripts. We encounter some food situations so frequently that we develop automatic patterns or habitual behaviors to navigate them. Eating scripts are the icebergs of our diet. There are some eating scripts we are clearly aware of, but many more lurk beneath the surface of our daily activities. And whether we see them or not, they can sink our best intentions. Here are some typical scripts. Now, this wouldn't apply to any of us, but I'll read them anyway. Breakfast: open newspaper, refill breakfast bowl, and eat until finished with paper. Dinner: finish eating food on plate, take additional helpings until others are done. Snack: find cable movie to watch, make popcorn. We all have breakfast scripts, snacking scripts, restaurant scripts, beverage scripts, cooking scripts, plate cleaning scripts, and so on. We also have scripts that tell us when it's time to stop eating. In fact, if you were to ask a number of people what it was that caused them to stop eating, only some of them would say, "I was full." Others would say they stopped when they ran out of time, or when their eating companions were through. Still others would say they stopped when the food was gone, when their television program was over, or when they'd finished whatever they were reading. I can't help but think of the scripts that we have in our minds while sitting. Scripts about ourselves, about others. Concepts. Concepts that give rise to habits that are become very stubborn. Here's an interesting one. When eating in groups of 4 or 8 people, light eaters ate more and heavy eaters ate less. Let's say you have a 1 hour lunch break. You can either choose to eat for an hour alone or in a group. If you're trying to lose weight, what should you do? It depends. If you tend to be a heavy eater, you should eat with the group, because this makes you more likely to exercise restraint. If you're a lighter eater, you should eat by yourself, because you'll stick more to your moderation. Men and women had opposite eating scripts for a date. Women thought it was more attractive and feminine to eat less. Guys thought it was studly and masculine to show they have voracious, healthy appetites, like real men should. Some of them ate more than they otherwise would have because they thought they were impressing their girlfriends with their macho eating behavior. They found that they told them stories of where men ate more or less, and the men who were tested on this rated the men in the stories who ate a lot as more masculine. Of course, TV, people who watch a lot of TV are more likely to be overweight than people who don't. The less TV people watch, the skinnier they are. TV is a triple eating threat. Aside from leading you to eat, it leads you to not pay attention to how much you eat, and it leads you to eat for too long. It's a scripted, conditioned ritual. We turn on the TV, we sit down in our favorite spot, we salivate, and we go get a snack. Eating or drinking gives us something to do with our hands, and it occupies us while we focus on the plot of our television show and on the question it raises. What else is on? Have I seen this one before? Did the Flintstones really happen? The basic rule: distractions of all kinds make us eat, forget how much we eat, and extend how long we eat, even when we're not hungry. And then he talks about the atmospherics of a restaurant, the music, whether it's candlelight or not, the kind of music, the waiter, the menu, the font, the names of the items on the menus. We taste what we think we'll taste. The menu names work in two ways. They entice us to order the item, and then they lead us to expect it will taste good. Same for soy. He showed that that men are more resistant to eating soy because they associate it with something very different than manly meat. Women saw soy largely through their view of tofu as something soft, delicate, and natural, just as they saw themselves. Eating it wouldn't be incompatible with their perception of themselves. But with men, they saw it as to eat it, they would have to give up a food they saw as strong and powerful, like themselves, for a food they saw as weak and wimpy. So it's had two strikes against it before it even got to their plate. Talks about comfort foods that are based largely on unconscious associations. They can be very different for different people. Talks about the importance of having stopping points. Having something, almost anything, to interrupt our eating gives us the chance to decide if we want to continue. Stopping points, too, makes me think of sitting and Zen practice more broadly, not just sitting, but the way that our awareness can bring in these little spaces in our daily lives where we come back to our senses, we come back to self-awareness, and then we have, from that, we have some freedom to decide whether we want to keep doing what we're doing. Talks about how to mindlessly eat better, all these points in your mindful eating plan. And then he talks about the diet danger zones. And these are the main types of people who, in their own way, have trouble limiting their food intake. There's the meal stuffer. They eat primarily during meal times, but then they eat to excess, cleaning everything on their plate. There's the snack grazer that eats between meals, the party binger, the restaurant indulger, and the desktop diner, or the dashboard diner. And then he gives advice for each type on how to how they design a different way, re-engineer their environment. Well, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.